This is the session on serving and shopping. How do they mix, or consumerism and Christian lifestyle? My name is Judy Essman.
I'm Susan Kylo.
And we decided through a mutual conversation to offer this program this week. We haven't ever offered it before, but it came out of several discussions that I had had for the last 4 weeks with classes that I have been leading that have been entitled When World Concerns Touch My Life. And there's been different topics within that larger topic, but one thing that I have been hearing from people in the classes is those things that they are most deeply concerned about in the world. And various things have come up, everything from fear of nuclear annihilation as a deep concern to what's happening to our family life, what about these swiftly changing values that I don't seem to understand, what about this what looks like greed in the world where people are consuming things so quickly, what about world hunger, how does that influence me and how do I influence it? People like you have been talking about those issues in these classes. But one woman said something to in one of my classes last week that really got my mind spinning. We were talking about how to make peace. And we started to talk about lifestyle and how we lived. And did that affect whether or not the world was peaceful? People were giving examples of different kinds of living and people who were living simple lifestyles and so on. And she said, you know, I don't know much about simple living. I don't know about simplicity particularly. But I do know that when I walk out of a gift shop and I have not bought anything, I congratulate myself. What's going on? And that really started me thinking. Because I do the same thing. If I go shopping and I escape buying anything, I feel better. Something didn't seem right. So I started to think about that, talked with Susan about it a little bit, and we decided that maybe we could pull together some ideas, share them with you, and then have us share our ideas about it and just see what we think. There's no right answer or solution we're trying to come up with particularly, but just let's throw this out and see what it's about. Is that a fair
introduction? I think that is. I brought my friend with me again, Judith Madison. In her book, Facing Up, she has this little writing on the clearance sale, which I'd like to share. It speaks also to what Judy was saying about going in and coming out without buying anything. Passing by the item in the store was difficult because it was on sale, clearance. It grew large before me, all its uses, the beautiful colors, the unique design, and my desire to have, possess, acquire, purchase grew to an emotion-charged pitch. I approached the sales clerk only to discover I could have two for even more savings. Two. I began to plot how I could use two, where I would store them, and who I could tell. And to compliment myself on thrift and wisdom, being at the right place at the right time, suddenly I knew, wrong place, wrong time. I didn't really need one. Certainly not two. I was trapped in bondage in a free country to the desire to have more and more, to satisfy emotions rather than needs. I redefined wisdom was really my wanting, and my thrift was simply greed. I walked away. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong reasons. Wrong God.
Well, we're going to approach the topic from a couple of different angles so that we can talk about them. I'm going to talk about them from the angle of the household. of the home and give you some ideas that I've pulled together and see what you think. Susan is going to talk about herself, I know, in her life, as well as she looks like she has several notes here, so there may be more that she's going to say. But before we do that, if you could just, for a minute, think about where you live. Think about back there. And here you are, Holden, away from home, away from your house, Hold. What, is there anything back there that you miss, that you'd like to have with you now, or that you'd like to be doing now that you're not doing? Anybody? Just mention it if there is.
Children.
Any other thing you miss?
I miss the news, what's going on around the radio.
Okay, communication of the larger world.
I carried a tape recorder here, but left the cord.
Okay, you miss your tape recorder cord.
So I got tape machine and can't use it.
But I just for us, if you need a cord, you can use mine. If it's a same kind of thing. Yeah, I'll bring it over.
Oh, so easy to film me.
I miss my dog.
I miss my garden. I have a flower garden. I miss that a lot. Working in it. Anything else?
Friends.
Friends. People who you're used to talking to.
I do not miss the telephone.
Okay. Let's talk about what we don't miss. Back there, here we are at Holden. What don't we miss about that household back there? Telephone we don't miss. Some of us.
Traffic.
Television.
Busyness of life.
It's that pace, that fast.
Grocery shopping. Telephone.
The telephone.
Woman back there mentioned friends, and to me you're a myth, and I can understand it, but for me, I don't at present because I'm so overjoyed in meeting new friends, friends I haven't met. That's where my attention is now, so I went back home where somewhat forgotten.
So you don't feel a gap particularly. Anything else you don't miss about that household back there?
Mailman.
Pavement, is that what you said?
Sidewalks.
Cement. Nice to have the earth beneath your feet, huh? Okay. Well, that I mostly just asked you that just to have you remember a little bit about the household back there. Seems to be having some clatter. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Well, I don't even know if these ideas are going to make sense to you. They make sense to me, and so I want to share them. If you become confused or something, let me know. I just know for me that when I go anywhere, and I have moved several times in my life, not with my parents, we didn't move very much, we kind of stayed in the same spot, but since I went away to college, and from then on I have moved from New York to Washington to the Midwest and so on. Wherever I move to, I work very quickly to make where I am a home. I'm like lightning about that. I hit the place and I work from dawn to midnight getting that place to be a home. Some of the people I have lived with have said, are we in a race about this? Do we have to put the garden in this summer? Can't we wait till next summer? I don't know, I feel just this passion that it has to be complete. I have to have the house. I have to have the home. I have to have a place to go to come back to live in, to work with. I've never quite understood that about myself. It seems sort of too much or something, although when I talk, some of you were nodding your heads like you understood that, which is nice to see. I know I'm not alone. I do that, I make that home, and yet, for some reason, it always feels to me like something's missing. or it never quite feels exactly the way I picture it will feel, or something. It's kind of like Christmas. I always think of the ideal Christmas and I plan the ideal Christmas and it never quite feels like it. And it's kind of the same way about home for me. I haven't quite known what to do about that until I stumbled on an author named Wendell Berry and started to read his book, which is in the bookstore and the library, called The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture. It wasn't a book that I particularly thought I would enjoy, and I found myself devouring it. He's a poet and an essayist and a farmer in Kentucky. He's done a lot of thinking about the United States and about our agriculture and about our society. He has a whole chapter on the household, and that was so wonderful that when I got married, I read part of the chapter at my wedding ceremony. Not a very romantic reading, but one that I wanted to remind me of what it was that I'm after. And so what I wanted to do was share with you a little excerpt from what he talked about household. I think it has to do, finally, with the woman in the gift shop. Okay, I am going to get back to her. All right. Well, I don't have to stand up, I guess. Sit down. Although, I just want to put some keywords up here so that you and we can keep them in mind. Barry says that our lives and our agriculture have one underlying thing, and that's a sense of unity, that we are united to the land and to each other, not just each other as neighbors and family, but at each other around the globe. It's kind of like the theme for this summer. One Lord, many members, we are all connected. He said that something has happened, that we have two roles in our culture, nurture and production, and somehow those things have gotten confused and we have lost the sense of unity. Now I'm going to show you how he does that. I just want those words up there so you can keep looking at them. He said that in all societies, certainly in the United States, all societies began in some ways with a household unit. That in hunting and gathering societies, where we went out and hunted or picked our food, we came back to a household to use that. Later on, when we became agricultural, we did the same thing. We cultivated and nurtured and grew our own food. We came back to the household to prepare it and nourish ourselves. He was saying that within the household, which I define as a union, not a unit and a union of mutual dependence and obligation that requires skill and discipline and hard work, that all people in a household had a nurturing role initially. And let me give you the example of the farmer. And some of you may be farmers or know farmers or have relatives that were farmers or whatever. I think many of us have connections with the rural life. You know we do. A good farmer, Barry said, was somebody called a husband who practiced husbandry, who sowed the seed and conserved the earth's bounty. The farmer was the midwife of the harvest and of the animals, and the motherer of the land and the animals. The task of the farmer was to nurture life. The work the farmer did was domestic, and it was bound to the household. Now, if you think about what you know about the farm, the early farm, that may make some sense. All my relatives are farmers, and I know that about them. Now, the person who was within the home in that same unit was also a nurturer. That's what people did. They nurtured. They nurtured. That person nurtured the home itself, the land around it, the garden, and the young people who were growing up in that household. That person provided the nourishment through food growing and food preparation and maintenance of the people's health. That person treated the illnesses and the injuries. Both people worked together. They cooperated. They were dependent. The skills involved in all those roles were very complicated. They required discipline and cooperation, and they were necessary skills. As a result, they had dignity. Those tasks were dignified. Now, as a little aside, they weren't necessarily equitable all the time. We know that there was that old adage, and my mother, who had moved from the farm to the city, from the spouse who was outside the household and the children and from other householders, and was given work to do from which most of the skill was removed. She saw that what she did was becoming less important. And she was ripe then for sales talk. She became an expert at being a customer. That's where she learned her skill. That's where she used her skills, was as a buyer. And then, he says, the tragedy is that women began to identify more with what they bought than with what they did. What they had became their identification rather than what they did. And so they bought more. They bought more labor-saving devices, which in turn took the skill out of what they knew how to do. They bought more manufactured, easily prepared foods, which in turn took the skill out of food preparation, which they once knew how to do. They furnished households, not because of what was needed or what crafts were available or they knew how to have someone do for them, but rather by the suggestions of the magazines who were used by the producers of the goods to help the women buy the goods. Thus, housewifery, which was once a very complicated and complex discipline, the basis for civilization, was reduced to purchasing agent. The role became simple, not easy. Simple and easy aren't the same. It became simplified. It became confining, and for some women, it became boring. Now, men were changing too. It wasn't just women. Men changed as well. Men found that they worked and played out of the household. The household no longer was his. I remember this very much when my father retired, and he retired out because of illness earlier than my parents thought he would. And he was in the house for a long time. My mother couldn't stand to have him around. The house was hers. He couldn't stand to be there because he had his opinions about how it should run. And they were totally stymied. When I would come home, they were just both sitting. She would refuse to work in front of him, and he would refuse to pick up anything and do it in the house because that was her work. What an estrangement, what a separation from the household, that basic unit. It would no longer belong to them. After retirement, they were both estranged. It's very sad. The house was no longer his. It had changed even his impulse. He knew how to conserve. He knew how to nurture. He knew how to cultivate. And yet, he had been taught or shown out in the world, outside the household, that that was uneconomical. It's important to buy in order that we all have jobs. To conserve is to put us out of work. That's what it looks like right now. Barry says, we cannot do this. We cannot separate ourselves so much from the household. We cannot damage it the way we have damaged it without damaging ourselves. He said, we have separated men and women from each other in a way that's artificial and is not true to our nature. He said, our work is no longer healing and unifying and important like it used to be. He said, imagine what this has done to marriages and imagine what it has done to families. He has a wonderful quote at the end of one of his sections, which I think is really true. He said, "We are not too good to work with our bodies. We can do this. But we are too good to work poorly, joylessly, selfishly, or by ourselves." And I think that's what's happened, and I think that's, for me, why every time I go to make a home, wherever I am, it doesn't feel united. It doesn't feel like it's complete or whole. And I'm beginning to try to look at how can I make that shift. One other thing I want to say is I'm as prone as the next person to walking into a store and saying, "I must buy something." I think I hit the store as soon as I got off the bus. No, I didn't. I got off the bus, I ate, because we all have to eat, right? And then went right to the store. That's what I knew how to do. I didn't go for a hike. I hit the store. So part of all of this is me talking about me, I want to say. Okay, that's all I want to say right now. Do you have any reactions to that before we go on?
I have a reaction to your wanting to make a home immediately.
Do you?
Because when we're here for a week, came into this bedroom with two beds and a table, not even a chair nor nothing. I wanted to do something and I didn't have anything to do it with. Next time I'll bring different things, because I'm going to have that room look a little better than it's looked this week.
Mm-hmm. For your sake, sort
for
of.
For my sake, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Something.
This is probably off a little.
Anything is on, let me tell you.
But I'm disturbed by the fact that so many of our young people feel certain things are necessary. I live in a college town, and we go behind them in the food line. Almost the first thing they pick up is all kinds of Cokes and soft drinks, and then their pizzas and so on and so forth. We just got through with a meeting with one of the men in charge. 80% of the young people at this college receive aid of some kind. And we see them going through the grocery line and picking up things we don't pick up. They have to build larger car lots, parking lots, because they all have to have cars. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has become part of it. And we were setting up two different scholarships. And one, there's over $800 that comes in annually for it. But they don't want to give that as one scholarship. You know, $1,000 or so. That kind of is beyond me. We want to encourage people to come. No, give it in, you know, $200 or $300. Because the young people understand that. That will buy a tape recorder and tapes and things for them. That's in their line of thinking. $1,000, oh, that's way over. That's, you know, to pay for tuition. No, they don't understand that. They will borrow money and pay that back in a few years. But a $200-$300 scholarship will buy them things that they feel they need, and that's within their thinking financially. That kind of threw me. Young people and how are we going to change that?
Well, does what I have said about the household fit any of that for you?
Well,
do you see
it
a connection?
Does, you see, that they have learned to become consumers and buyers and need. But I think it's unfortunate that I know a young man who had difficulty making his house payments, but he spent $3 a day on soft drinks and I don't know how much on cigarettes. Mm-hmm. I could take his and buy his groceries and feed the family at three without any problem, and I think feed them well.
So you still have some of those skills.
But you see, they can't see that. You can't.
Well,
see,
they may not have. You still have those skills, some of those skills.
But what are we doing? So we're making the young people think these are essentials.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
What you were talking about there is one of the reasons why the world is hungry. We shifted to production. I see it in Mexico and everything there, that everything is being done for production.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear him back there? Can you speak louder?
I said what was said earlier by her is one of the reasons why we have world hunger there. I have seen it down in Mexico, and I've seen it in the Philippines and other places where multinational corporations are only have one thing in mind, and the production of a product that can be sold and a profit earned, not to feed the people. They're feeding our world now would not be a problem if we would go back to raising for nurture, in other words, existence.
What seems to be happening in the third world countries too is that the people are leaving the land to go into the urban areas where there may or may not be jobs too.
Right.
And then the land is being taken away from them to put into production to give us our sugar and coffee and
tobacco.
Bananas.
Over here, Julia.
I wanted to skip back to what this woman said here. I was talking with another woman my age yesterday, and we were saying how we're sort of getting conflicting messages from how we are saying now we would like to live a more simplistic lifestyle. And yet we're getting messages from our parents and our grandparents. Why would you want to live a simplistic lifestyle? We've worked so hard to give you so much. Pop and Coke, I mean, that's something nebulous, who knows if that's good or bad, but other goods that people my age are buying, it's, we're getting the message is, you can have this, luxuries. We've worked for you so you will be able to have these luxuries, and yet we're saying, now we don't want the luxuries, we want to live a lifestyle. So it's mixed messages. I don't know what I'm really saying except that we are getting mixed messages.
Mm-hmm. You're saying what you mean. Mm-hmm. And I've gone along with that for years, that parents give too much to their kids, they don't let them have the satisfaction of earning something for themselves and living a simple life.
And learning the skills takes to do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And your parents and grandparents give you, and so those that aren't getting it from their grandparents still think they should have it. And they're going out and buying the thing.
Yeah.
Which creates a problem.
Right.
But you're saying almost that when you express the need or the desire or the interest in living more simply, other people feel like it's almost a slap in the face against the cultural values.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with what has been said about perhaps grandparents and parents wanting their children to have more, but I think another thing that promotes this more than anything else is too. TV.
Mm-hmm.
How many times can you sit in front of a TV, but what you don't see, $50 blue jeans being promoted, or you name it. And if the kids are watching TV, that's what I gotta have, because that's the end thing.
Mm-hmm. Or the lawnmower, you know, and the snowmobile, and
the four-wheel drive truck.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just geared to the young adults, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Adults are prone to it too. Do you want to say some?
Speaking of being an adult who's prone to that, up until the time that I began my ordained ministry in Sudan, which is that small town in northern Minnesota, I had not been one, the purchasing agent, in the same sense that most women who are homemakers had become. My lifestyle was, I had all used furniture, you know, hand-me-down furnitures and hand-me-down dishes, and I was fine with that. Never had a sense of needing, I never went shopping when I traveled. And it made me nervous to go with friends who wanted, you know, the first thing they wanted to do was to go into the stores and look around and buy things. I love to eat, of course, that's my, so as my friends are going in there to look for something to buy to take home, I want to go to the local restaurant that serves something that I can taste, which is still consuming and still purchasing and still doing that. But I just was never, you know, to have things that I had earned. You know, that was not, that has never been something that I was caught up in. I didn't think. Until I went to this small town in northern Minnesota, where a very industrialized area, the men, and they were primarily men who worked outside the home, were laborers in an industry, taconite industry. They worked shifts. They made good wages when they were working, good benefits. And they would go at the, you know, different times of the day, and then they'd bring home the money. And the women would say, well, we get paid today. And they would go out and buy things. Well, one of the things that they did a lot of, because it was a small town and there wasn't many places to go and shop, they had these home parties. I attended and bought Tupperware things for my walls at the home decorator parties, toy parties, crystal parties, and I bought in all of them. And I have this, and then I bought a home, which I never really knew I wanted to do. And so now I have a house, and I have crystal, and I have things on my wall, and I have a whole cupboard full of Tupperware, which is, you know, and I use it because I do like to cook, and I had a garden. For the first time. And that felt really good, the garden did. But when I had to come here, when I chose to come here, I had to figure out what to do about all of those things. Oh, I know what else. I had a microwave. And the microwave I bought because I thought it would help me to eat better, and it did. As a, you know, with the kind of schedule that I have, I was more prone to run into the house and grab bread and make sandwiches and eat potato chips and Coke and whatever, other than fix, you know, a meal that would be more healthy with vegetables and salads and all that. So I used the microwave for that, and it did help. But I, you know, I had all these things, and I couldn't bring anything with me. I didn't need furniture. I didn't need my Tupperware. I needed some of the things on my walls, but I didn't need the things I bought. I needed things that helped me make a home, the things people had given to me and made for me, you know, that were on my wall. I didn't need anything. So I sold my microwave, which I'd only had for about 8 months, and the two tables, or the table it stood on that somebody made for me, my bookcases, my dining room table, and my living room couch. And it felt so good. Now, if I could just sell the house, does anybody want it? I don't know. I was really surprised at what had happened to me and how much of what I was earning was going into making payments on things that I really wasn't very attached to. And it's been a surprise. For my lifestyle, and I think it's because I'm also a single person, that to be attached to those things was kind of like not having to attach to people. And coming here is helping me to get back, to get back into a focus of really how I want to live my life that will be full for me and full in terms of how I relate to others.
I'd like to make a comment on those quote-unquote parties. In small communities, I've noticed that consumerism aside, it becomes a social activity for small communities. And I think that if somehow they could have something that would take up their spare time and they're maybe selling clubs or clothing for the church or something, card parties. I'm a bridge player on the team.
Oh, good.
And things like that. And somebody invites me to a Tupperware party or crystal. Oh, heaven forbid. I have too many other interests.
But yeah, I understand that. And I think in some ways that maybe what it sounded like I was saying too. For me, it was a way of
socializing with people. And I know that that's why those things were happening and why I was invited and why I went, and I didn't have to buy those.
You feel obligated
to help my friend out? Yeah. Yeah. But essentially what I, you know, what I wanted to do with this was just to sort of share, as Judy and I were talking about this, is to share my story, my experience with it. A part of what I also wanted to do today was to talk about how I think in some ways we have come to this point because of the way in which we have interpreted the scripture relating to creation and our role in that. I'm not sure how, if it's going to relate as well as I thought it would, Judy, in terms of what you had shared. But in Genesis, in the first chapter, when God has, God, the order of creation, God creates humankind in his image, in at the end, towards the end, at the end. Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And then we have the next verse. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And I think the two words that have come to us are subdue and dominion. And the way in which we understand those words is the way in which we come to understand how all of this has, I think, has been allowed to happen. I looked up the word subdue. I did this the other day, so I love the dictionary. It helps me to focus. There were three definitions for the word subdue: to conquer and subjugate, or to quiet or bring under control, or to make less intense. Now, which one is it, do you think, that we most often hear first? To quiet or bring under control? I hear conquer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that would be, yeah. And the other for dominion is control or exercise of control. Sphere of influence or control is what dominion is defined as. So God says we can, I mean, if we go by the way we understand these words, we are then to conquer and subjugate the creation. We are to control or exercise a control over it. It's a lot of power. And for me, the question then comes down to, is it a right? Has God given me the right to all of this? Is that how I understand those words? I don't think that that's what that is intended to be. What?
A right to use. To me, consumerism is very similar to what we were talking about in our Bible study this morning.
Mm-hmm.
There. That we need to, at times, to reflect or remove ourselves from that so we can use the blessings and the gifts that God has given. And that's the idea in this book, Philistinia, the desert. And it's a beautiful book because where a person can go and completely remove himself on the bare necessities, bread and water, bread and tea, for a period of time so he can converse, pray to God, and study and reflect and refresh himself, and then go back into the temporal world and be a better Christian. And I think we all need those types of things.
Okay. I think, too, though, that we, and I, that's good. You probably didn't hear all of what he was saying, but it, it was almost as if within the Bible study this morning that which you need, we sometimes need to withdraw and to reflect and to pray. And he's coming in to turn over the tape.
Quietly.
Oh, sure. But to go back to those, understand what our relationship with God and the creation really is, we hear those words then as being caretakers and agents. We become agents of God rather than privileged by God or given rightful ownership to something that is around us. One of the big struggles that I had in working with people who were becoming rapidly unemployed in the area that I was at was that that whole attitude about I worked for this, I earned it, I deserve it, and I shouldn't have to give it up in order to survive. Everything, as I understand the scripture, everything we have essentially belongs to God. And there is no right, or, you know, we have no right to those things in a human right to those things. We may have a civil right, but we don't have a human right to those things. And that was a real struggle, you know, where are we in our relationship to the creation, to being God's servant. Reading Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. We have what we have from God on loan, as I understand Genesis 1 and as I understand the Psalm, and that there are limits and we have a responsibility. It is a privilege. It is a blessing. And I think that's when we get back to what the Bible study was this morning. It is a blessing that God has created all of this and continues to be involved in all of this, the ongoingness of the creation. And that we have, in our relationship with God, a commitment to make the best use of what he has given us in relationship not to ourselves, but to everyone. We are to make use of what God has made us agents or caretakers of. We are to take care of it so that everybody can participate in it.
It's a blessing also that we have to suffer a little bit in order to...
I have a hard time with that. there's no getting around suffering, but, you know, what do you think? I mean, about suffering. That it's a blessing to suffer? That it's good that we suffer?
If we do it for our strength and the betterment of our brothers and sisters.
Okay.
And we ourselves, I think, can be nurtured through pain and through suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a firm believer of this because of my experience.
Mm-hmm.
There was a study made, and the question was asked of some psychiatrists, I believe, as to who they would rather consult, a poor man or a wealthy one. And the answer was a wealthy one, because a wealthy man knows that his wealth and his belongings and his possessions are not the answer to his problems.
Hmm. That's interesting. It is. And, you know, being poor doesn't necessarily make you righteous. I don't like being poor. I don't like being poor. I don't like not having things. No. But why do I, you know, what is, am I the only one that I'm supposed to be concerned about?
I'd like to get back to what you said about that we are kind of indebted to promoting the economy, because in so doing, buying things, and so doing, we create jobs and raise the standard of living and so forth. And that's kind of a put down to the nourishing part. I mean that we should take care of what we got and not mm-hmm. promote all this mm-hmm. business. I think I'm kind of a misfit in modern society. My wife thinks I'm a tight one. But I don't enjoy buying things and getting things. I hate to shop. I wear things until they're in rags, and you know, not because you know, it's just because I feel comfortable that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember after the war, we lived among the British in northern Germany for a while, and that was a time when the British had kind of a hard time. You know, they didn't have much to go on. And the motto that was among so many of them was to bend and make do. That kind of stuck in my mind as a good motto for life. Don't think you got to go out and get new things every time something gets old. Mend it. Make do, you know. But that's not a popular philosophy nowadays. And I think it's a wholesome philosophy in many ways at times when you don't have much. But it's not a very popular philosophy. And I can't quite figure out, now how do we bridge the gap between these two?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I think there's probably some good in both of them. But how do we make them work?
Yeah, I think that the bridge is Jesus Christ. You know, and the bridge is the way in which he taught us how to live. And what he said to us about what is meaningful in our lives. He was the good shepherd who said, the one who's going to rule is the one who serves. In a sense, it is how we feel about ourselves and what, how we feel about ourselves. Not do we feel about ourselves because of what we have or can do for ourselves or because of what he has done for us. And do I act out of my response to my response of graciousness to God for Jesus Christ, or do I act out of a sense of I did it myself, you know, that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if I'm living, and I don't always do this, you know, this is the preacher in me talking, I think, but I really believe that this is the way direction and the way in which I would like to. Yeah, you know, to that point where I can live my life as a response to God's gift to me, as opposed to living my life as a person who has somehow achieved goodness to the point where I deserve to have those things.
See, I don't like the men. That's why. And there's nothing wrong with
that's
they
right.
Have new clothes if you need them or nice things. But if they become your God and you're possessed by
that's
that is wrong.
Right. Yes.
You know, I married a man like you in some ways, I'm not quite like you, but I was taught very early on how to be a good customer. And my mom took me out and she showed me the ropes. And I married somebody who doesn't really care about buying, and when it's forced in that position, it gets quite upset about it, and loves the old things, although I'm a better mender than he is, and so on. But what I realized in our marriage is, you know, is I see that what's in the middle between us, his conservatism about that, and I want to be this good customer and real skilled and show off my expertise or something. But in the middle of that is where we're both learning. And I don't know if it's Jesus in the middle of that or there's something that's informing us both when we don't lock horns, but when we look at the differences and try to understand those, it's like I feel like I get freed up from my thing and he gets freed up from having to rigidly wear the same dirty ripped pants all the time, and he feels that he can go buy something, but it's like something happens in the middle, in that tension, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say that sometimes those opposites can be really informing if we don't lock horns all the time.
Maybe children will help you develop that.
Well, we have children. Oh, well, there's plenty of food for thought around the children.
We are different.
And if you do not feel good about yourself, how in the world can you go out and make someone else feel good? Because one person feels that I'm going to wear clothes, I'm going to not have any material things, and that's the way I want you to be. You cannot feel good about yourself. And so each one of us has to work with that.
We have our own paths we have to work
with. Yeah.
Yeah, but isn't there a great difference between material things of what you want and what you need?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you distinguish between
well,
the two?
Well, a friend of mine had a daughter in college, and she would write her mother and say she wanted this. Her mother would write her back and say, do you absolutely need this? You know, I suppose it was something in clothesline or something that the other college friends had. And I imagine with clothing, and but the mother told me, she said, well, I would write Janice and say, well, do you absolutely need this? And that kind of stops you. And
do you know the difference between what you need and what you want? Do all of you feel clear about that?
No, absolutely not. I was thinking, if my mother had said that to me, whether I might have reflected and said, I don't really need it, but I'm going to have it anyway. For some reason, you know, to have to be told, well, do you really need it, wouldn't have dissuaded me as a college student.
They say this year's wants are next year's needs.
Mm-hmm. Ah, we grow into
what are our needs?
Well,
I know, but just in terms of what our needs, how do we define needs? I think that's a really good
thing.
I'd like to go back to what you gave us, our beginning, the agricultural area, I mean the home. The children brought up in the home would be taught, they were the boys to be the outside work and the girls on the inside work. And now, the home doesn't do that. As material things have come in, as the people have gone out for cash and you've become a consumer, how many homes actually teach the children, or should it be the home? Should it be the school or who, or the church? It's going to teach the children to be this wise consumer. The parents, oh, get out of the kitchen, you know, you mess it up and then I have to clean up and I can do it much faster than you can, and when we go shopping, old kid grabs something, put it back, can't have it, and this kind of stuff. Now, when does, or where should that be? Where does this person become, or taught the traits that some of us were taught?
Are you saying be a wise consumer or be a wise householder?
Well, both. A wise householder will be a wise consumer.
Yeah.
Or you can
yeah,
be a wise consumer. But where do we teach that now? Where do they get that? Do we expect the home, the school, the church?
I would expect that the people who had those skills would begin to teach them again. I mean, just the notion to me that quilt making is becoming important to people again, that there are books in the Holden bookstore on how to, on windmills, and, you know, things that people used to know about that other people who don't haven't been taught want to find out. I think the more the people who have those skills can begin to offer them, sewing, knitting, and mending.
Because some of that has been given to children along the line, that you don't have to go out and buy a new shirt or a new pair of socks. You could mend them a little bit and teach the children that.
Put on a new costume.
And put on some little thing. Would it be better if I give you a quarter to spend it for a Coke, or would it be better to get a hot chocolate, or would it be better to save it and give it to the church? So, but you know what I mean. To get them to see that. But do we do that?
Well,
I would go back even more than just learning how to do the quilting and all of them. Is that the only reason, only time that, from my understanding, is that we would want to do that is if we first have a sense of community and wanting to work together with whomever it is that we live.
That has to come first for me, for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Before I'll be at all interested in sitting down and working on a project or mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. make, you know, I'll never be a quilt maker.
Mm-hmm.
But,
unity,
you know,
that,
the
unity
thing,
connection with each other.
Yeah, that to me seems to be, how do we get back to that? In our families are not the same anymore.